Capitalism, The Unknown Ideal, by Ayn Rand. Continued. Disc 6. Psychologically, the UN has contributed a great deal to the gray swamp of demoralization, of cynicism, bitterness, hopelessness, fear, and nameless guilt, which is swallowing the Western world. But the communist world has gained a moral sanction, a stamp of civilized respectability from the Western world. It has gained the West's assistance in deceiving its victims. It has gained the status and prestige of an equal partner, thus establishing the notion that the difference between human rights and mass slaughter is merely a difference of political opinion. The declared goal of the communist countries is the conquest of the world. What they stand to gain from a collaboration with the relatively free countries is the latter's material, financial, scientific, and intellectual resources. The free countries have nothing to gain from the communist countries. Therefore, the only form of common policy or compromise possible between two such parties is the policy of property owners who make piecemeal concessions to an armed thug in exchange for his promise not to rob them. The UN has delivered a larger part of the globe's surface and population into the power of Soviet Russia than Russia could ever hope to conquer by armed force. The treatment accorded to Katanga versus the treatment accorded to Hungary is a sufficient example of UN policies. An institution allegedly formed for the purpose of using the united might of the world to stop an aggressor has become the means of using the united might of the world to force the surrender of one helpless country after another into the aggressor's power. Who but a concrete-bound epistemological savage could have expected any other results from such an experiment in collaboration? What would you expect from a crime-fighting committee whose board of directors included the leading gangsters of the community? Only a total evasion of basic principles could make this possible, and this illustrates the reason why 3. When opposite basic principles are clearly and openly defined, it works to the advantage of the rational side. When they are not clearly defined but are hidden or evaded, it works to the advantage of the irrational side. In order to win, the rational side of any controversy requires that its goals be understood. It has nothing to hide, since reality is its ally. The irrational side has to deceive, to confuse, to evade, to hide its goals. Fog, murk, and blindness are not the tools of reason. They are the only tools of irrationality. No thought, knowledge, or consistency is required in order to destroy. Unremitting thought, enormous knowledge, and a ruthless consistency are required in order to achieve or create. Every error, evasion, or contradiction helps the goal of destruction. Only reason and logic can advance the goal of construction. The negative requires an absence, ignorance, impotence, irrationality. The positive requires a presence, an existent, knowledge, efficacy, thought. The spread of evil is the symptom of a vacuum. Whenever evil wins, it is only by default, by the moral failure of those who evade the fact that there can be no compromise on basic principles. In any compromise between food and poison, it is only death that can win. In any compromise between good and evil, it is only evil that can profit. Atlas shrugged. Chapter 15. Is Atlas Shrugging? By Ayn Rand. As the title of this discussion indicates, its theme is the relationship of the events presented in my novel, Atlas Shrugged, to the actual events of today's world. Or to put the question in a form which has often been addressed to me, is Atlas Shrugged a prophetic novel or a historical one? The second part of the question seems to answer the first. If some people believe that Atlas Shrugged is a historical novel, this means that it was a successful prophecy. The truth of the matter can best be expressed as follows. Although the political aspects of Atlas Shrugged are not its central theme, nor its main purpose, my attitude toward these aspects, during the years of writing the novel, was contained in a brief rule I had set for myself. The purpose of this book is to prevent itself from becoming prophetic. The book was published in 1957. Since then, I have received many letters and heard many comments which amounted in essence to the following. When I first read Atlas Shrugged, I thought that you were exaggerating. But then I realized suddenly, while reading the newspapers, that the things going on in the world today are exactly like the things in your book. And so they are, only more so. The present state of the world, the political events, proposals, and ideas of today, are so grotesquely irrational that neither I nor any other novelist could ever put them into fiction. No one would believe them. A novelist could not get away with it. Only a politician might imagine that he can. The political aspects of Atlas Shrugged are not its theme, but one of the consequences of its theme. The theme is the role of the mind in man's existence, and, as a corollary, the presentation of a new code of ethics, the morality of rational self-interest. The story of Atlas Shrugged shows what happens to the world when the men of the mind, the originators and innovators in every line of rational endeavor, go on strike and vanish in protest against an altruist collectivist society. There are two key passages in Atlas Shrugged that give a brief summary of its meaning. The first is a statement of John Galt. There is only one kind of man who have never been on strike in human history. Every other kind and class have stopped when they so wished, and have presented demands to the world claiming to be indispensable, except the men who have carried the world on their shoulders, have kept it alive, have endured torture as sole payment, but have never walked out on the human race. Well, their turn has come. Let the world discover who they are, what they do, and what happens when they refuse to function. This is the strike of the men of the mind, Miss Taggart. This is the mind on strike. The second passage, which explains the title of the novel, is, "Mr. Reardon," said Francisco, his voice solemnly calm, "if you saw Atlas, the giant who holds the world on his shoulders, if you saw that he stood, blood running down his chest, his knees buckling, his arms trembling, but still trying to hold the world aloft with the last of his strength, and the greater his effort, the heavier the world bore down upon his shoulders, what would you tell him to do?" "I don't know. What could he do? What would you tell him?" "To shrug." The story of Atlas Shrugged presents the conflict of two fundamental antagonists, two opposite schools of philosophy, or two opposite attitudes toward life. As a brief means of identification, I shall call them the reason-individualism-capitalism axis versus the mysticism-altruism-collectivism axis. The story demonstrates that the basic conflict of our age is not merely political or economic, but moral and philosophical. That the dominant philosophy of our age is a virulent revolt against reason. That the so-called redistribution of wealth is only a superficial manifestation of the mysticism-altruism-collectivism axis. That the real nature and deepest, ultimate meaning of that axis is anti-man, anti-mind, anti-life. Do you think that I was exaggerating? During and after the writing of Atlas Shrugged, I kept a file, which, formally, should be called a research or documentation file. For myself, I called it the horror file. Let me give you a few samples from it. Here is an example of modern ideology from an alumni faculty seminar entitled The Distrust of Reason at Wesleyan University in June 1959. Perhaps in the future, reason will cease to be important. Perhaps for guidance in time of trouble, people will turn not to human thought, but to the human capacity for suffering. Not the universities with their thinkers, but the places and people in distress, the inmates of asylums and concentration camps, the helpless decision makers in bureaucracy, and the helpless soldiers in foxholes. These will be the ones to lighten man's way, to refashion his knowledge of disaster into something creative. We may be entering a new age. Our heroes may not be intellectual giants like Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein, but victims like Anne Frank, who will show us a greater miracle than thought. They will teach us how to endure, how to create good in the midst of evil, and how to nurture love in the presence of death. Should this happen, however, the university will still have its place. Even the intellectual man can be an example of creative suffering. Do you think that this is a rare exception, a weird extreme? On January 4, 1963, Time published the following news story. Ultimate performance in society, not just brains and grades, should be the admissions criterion of top colleges, says headmaster Leslie R. Severinghouse of the Haverford School near Philadelphia. In the Journal of the Association of College Admissions Counselors, he warns against the highly intelligent, aggressive, personally ambitious, and socially indifferent and unconcerned egotist. Because these self-centered, bright students have little to offer either now or later, colleges should be ready to welcome other good qualities. Who says that brains and motivated performance represent the dimensions of excellence? Is not social concern a facet of excellence? Is it not exciting to find a candidate who believes that no man liveth unto himself? What about leadership, integrity, the ability to communicate both ideas and friendship? May we discount spiritual eagerness? And why should we pass over cooperation with others in good causes, even at some sacrifice of one's own scholastic achievement? What about graciousness and decency? None of this shows up on college board scores, chides Severinghouse. Colleges must themselves believe in the potential of young people of this sort. Consider the meaning of this. If your husband, wife, or child were stricken with a deadly disease, of what use would the doctor's social concern or graciousness be to you? If that doctor had sacrificed his own scholastic achievement? If our country is threatened with nuclear destruction, will our lives depend on the intelligence and ambition of our scientists, or on their spiritual eagerness and capacity to communicate friendship? I would not put a passage of that kind into the mouth of a character in the most exaggerated farce satire. I would consider it too absurdly grotesque. And yet this is said, heard, and discussed seriously in an allegedly civilized society. Are you inclined to believe that theories of this kind will have no results in practice? I quote from the Rochester Times-Union of February 18, 1960, from an article entitled, Is Our Talent Running Out? Is this mighty nation running short of talent? At this point in history, with Russia and the United States in deadly competition, could this nation fall behind because of a lack of brain power? Dr. Harry Lionel Shapiro, chairman of the Department of Anthropology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, says, there is a growing uneasiness, not yet fully expressed, that the supply of competence is running short. The medical profession, he says, is profoundly worried about the matter. Studies have shown that today's medical students, on the basis of grades, are inferior to those of a decade ago. Some spokesmen for the profession have been inclined to blame this on the dramatic and financial appeal of other professions in this space age, engineering and other technological fields. But Dr. Shapiro says, this seems to be a universal complaint. The anthropologist spoke before a group of science writers at Ardsley-on-Hudson. This same group listened to some 25 scientists over a two-week period and heard the same lament from engineers, physicists, a meteorologist, and many others. These scientists, outstanding spokesmen for their fields, found this subject of far greater importance than the need for more money. Dr. William O. Baker, vice president in charge of research at Bell Telephone Laboratories in Murray Hill, New Jersey, one of the top scientists in the country, said more research is needed, but that it will come not as a result of more money. It all depends on ideas, he said. Not very many, but they have to be new ideas. Dr. Baker argued that the National Institute of Health has continually increased its grants, but the results of the work have remained on a level, if they are not on the downgrade. Eugene Cohn, public relations director of the American Physical Society, said that in physics, we are not getting anywhere near enough first-class people. Dr. Sidney Ingram, vice president of the Engineering Manpower Commission, said the situation is absolutely unique in the history of Western civilization. This news story was not given any prominence in our press. It reflects the first symptoms of anxiety over a situation which may still be hidden from the general public. But the same situation in Great Britain has become so obvious that it cannot be hidden any longer, and it is being discussed in terms of headlines. The British have coined a name for it, They call it the brain drain. Let me remind you, parenthetically, that in Atlas Shrugged, John Galt states, referring to the strike, "I have done by plan and intention what had been done throughout history by silent default." And he lists the various ways in which exceptional men had perished, in which intelligence had gone on strike against tyranny, psychologically, deserting any mystic altruist collectivist society. You may also remember Dagny's description of Galt before she meets him, which he later repeats to her. "The man who's draining the brains of the world." No, I do not mean to imply that the British have plagiarized my words. What is much more significant is that they haven't. Most of them undoubtedly have never read Atlas Shrugged. What is significant is that they are facing and groping to identify the same phenomenon. I quote from a news story in the New York Times of February 11, 1964. "The Labour Party is calling for a government study of the emigration of British scientists to the United States, a problem known here as the brain drain. Labour's action followed the disclosure that Professor Ian Bush and his research team are leaving Birmingham University for the Worcester Foundation for Experimental Biology in Shrewsbury, Massachusetts. Professor Bush, who is 35 years old, heads the Department of Physiology at Birmingham. His team of 9 scientists has been investigating the treatment of mental diseases with drugs. Tonight it was learned that a leading physicist, Professor Maurice Price, and a top cancer research pathologist, Dr. Leonard Weiss, would take posts in the United States. Tom Dalyell, a Labour spokesman on science, will ask if the Prime Minister, Sir Alec Douglas Home, will appoint a Royal Commission to consider the whole problem of the training, recruitment, and retention of scientific manpower for service in Britain. Professor Bush's decision was termed tragic by Sir George Pickering, president of the British Medical Association. He described the professor as the most brilliant pupil I ever had, and one of the most brilliant people I have ever met. From the New York Times of February 12th, "The furor over Britain's loss of scientific talent was intensified today when a foremost theoretical physicist said he was leaving for the United States. Dr. John Anthony Popel, superintendent of the Basic Physics Division at the National Physical Laboratory, said he was going to the Carnegie Institute of Technology in Pittsburgh in about a month. Afternoon newspapers used large headlines to report the move, the 13th since the weekend. One paper's front page headline read, 'Another one down the brain drain.' From the New York Times of February 13th, "With the announcement today of the impending departure of at least 5 more scientists from Britain, the nation began searching with new anxiety for root causes of the exodus." The story names 2 of the departing scientists, Dr. Ray Guillory, 34-year-old associate professor of anatomy at University College London, and also from University College Dr. Eric Shooter, 39, an assistant professor of biochemistry. From the New York Times of February 16th, "With Britain in a furor over the steady departure of her scientists, the nation is again searching for the causes of the exodus and demanding remedies. The brain drain, as the departure of scientists is called here, is not new to Britain. For decades, foreign universities and other institutions of learning and research, especially in the United States, have been drawing scientific talent from Britain. In the last academic year, Britain lost 160 senior university teachers, about 60 of them to the United States, according to a survey published by the Association of University Teachers. British scientists with newly acquired PhDs have been leaving the country permanently at a rate of at least 140 a year, according to a report last year by the Royal Society. This would be about 12% of the nation's output. Most commonly, the scientists who depart permanently explain that funds available for research equipment and staff in the United States cannot be matched at home. Some say frankly that they are attracted by salaries 2 and 3 times higher than they get in Britain, and also by what they consider a greater general regard in the United States for scientific effort and achievement. Others complain about the shortage of senior posts in universities, about the administrative jungle through which research grants must pass in Britain, and about what they term the mean, controlling hand of the Treasury in all university grants. What intellectual arguments are being offered to the scientists as an inducement to prevent them from leaving, and what practical remedies are being proposed? Quinton Hogg, Secretary of State for Education and Science, appealed to the patriotism of scientists to stay at home. "It is better to be British than anything else," he said. An earlier story, The New York Times, October 31, 1963, stated that a report submitted by a committee headed by Sir Burke Trend, Secretary of the Cabinet, calls for reshaping Britain's civil science setup and for giving increased powers to the Minister of Science. There is, of course, a great deal of implicit and explicit indignation against American wealth and big business, which the British seem to regard as chiefly to blame for the flight of their scientific talent. Now I want to call your attention to two significant facts: the age and the professions of the scientists who were mentioned by name in these stories. Most of them are in their 30s. Most of them are connected with theoretical medicine. Socialized medicine is an established institution of Britain's political system. What future would brilliant young men be able to achieve under socialized medicine? Draw your own conclusions about the causes of the brain drain, about the future welfare of those left behind in the welfare state, and about the role of the mind in man's existence. The next time you hear or read reports about the success of socialized medicine in Great Britain and in the other welfare states of Europe, the reports brought by the superficial, concrete-bound mentalities who cannot see beyond the range of the moment and who declare that they observe no change in the conscientious efficiency of the family doctors. Remember that the source of the family doctor's efficiency, knowledge, and power lies in the laboratories of theoretical medicine, and that that source is drying up. This is the real price which a country pays for socialized medicine, a price which does not appear on the cost sheets of the state planners, but which will not take long to appear in reality. At present, we lag behind Great Britain on the road to the collectivist abyss, but not very far behind. In recent years, our newspapers have been mentioning alarming reports on the state of the enrollment in our medical schools. There was a time when these schools had a much greater number of applicants than could be accepted, and only the ablest students, those with the highest academic grades and records, had a chance to be admitted. Today, the number of applicants is falling, and according to some reports, will soon be less than the number of openings available in our medical schools. Consider the growth of socialized medicine throughout the world. Consider the Medicare plan in this country. Consider the strike of the Canadian doctors in Saskatchewan and the recent strike of the doctors in Belgium. Consider the fact that in every instance, the overwhelming majority of the doctors fought against socialization and that the moral cannibalism of the welfare statists did not hesitate to force them into slavery at the point of a gun. The picture was particularly eloquent in Belgium, with thousands of doctors fleeing blindly, escaping from the country, with the allegedly humanitarian government resorting to the crude Nazi-like militaristic measure of drafting the doctors into the army in order to force them back into practice. Consider it, and then read the statement of Dr. Hendricks in Atlas Shrugged, the surgeon who went on strike in protest against socialized medicine. "I have often wondered at the smugness with which people assert their right to enslave me, to control my work, to force my will, to violate my conscience, to stifle my mind. Yet what is it that they expect to depend on when they lie on an operating table under my hands?" That is the question that should be asked of the altruistic slave drivers of Belgium. The next time you hear a discussion of Medicare, give some thought to the future, particularly to the future of your children, who will live at a time when the best brains available will no longer choose to go into medicine. Ragnar Donnarskjold, the pirate in Atlas Shrugged, said that he was fighting against the idea that need is a sacred idol requiring human sacrifices, that the need of some men is the knife of a guillotine hanging over others, and that the extent of our ability is the extent of our danger, so that success will bring our heads down on the block while failure will give us the right to pull the cord. This is the essence of the morality of altruism. The greater a man's achievement and the greater society's need of him, the more vicious the treatment he receives, and the closer he comes to the status of a sacrificial animal. Businessmen who provide us with the means of livelihood, with jobs, with labor-saving devices, with modern comforts, with an ever-rising standard of living, are the men most immediately and urgently needed by society. They have been the first victims, the hated, smeared, denounced, exploited scapegoats of the mystic altruist-collectivist axis. Doctors come next. It is precisely because their services are so crucially important and so desperately needed that the doctors are now the targets of the altruists' attack on a worldwide scale. As to the present condition of businessmen, let me mention the following. After completing Atlas Shrugged, I submitted it in galley proofs to a railroad expert for a technical checkup. The first question he asked me after he had read it was, "Do you realize that all the laws and directives you invented are on our statute books already?" "Yes," I answered, "I realize it." And that is what I want my readers to realize. In my novel, I presented these issues in terms of abstractions which expressed the essence of government controls and of statist legislation at any time and in any country. But the principles of every edict and every directive presented in Atlas Shrugged, such as the Equalization of Opportunity Bill or Directive 10-289, can be found, and in cruder forms, in our antitrust laws. In that accumulation of non-objective, undefinable, unjudicable statutes, you will find every variant of penalizing ability for being ability, of penalizing success for being success, of sacrificing productive genius to the demands of envious mediocrity. You will find such rulings as the forced breakup of large companies or the divorcement of companies from their subsidiaries, which is my Equalization of Opportunity Bill, the forcing of established concerns to share with any newcomer the facilities it had taken them years to create, the compulsory licensing or the outright confiscation of patents, and on top of this last, the order that the victims teach their own competitors how to use these patents. The only thing that stands between us and the level of social disintegration presented in Atlas Shrugged is the fact that the statists do not dare as yet to enforce the antitrust laws to the full extent of their power. But the power is there, and you can observe the accelerating process of its widening application year by year. Now you might think, however, that the railroad unification plan and the steel unification plan, which I introduced toward the end of Atlas Shrugged, have no counterpart in real life. I thought so too. I invented them as a development dictated by the logic of events to illustrate the last stages of a society's collapse. These two plans were typical collectivist devices for helping the weakest members of an industry at the expense of the strongest by means of forcing them to pool their resources. I thought these plans were a bit ahead of our time. I was wrong. I quote from a news story of March 17, 1964. The three television networks have been asked by the federal government to consider a tentative plan under which each would turn over a share of its programs to existing or new TV stations that might operate from a competitive disadvantage. A companion suggestion, also put forth for discussion by the Federal Communications Commission, would compel some stations now affiliated with one network to accept affiliation with an alternative chain. The proposals, which in effect call upon the haves of the television industry to help the have-nots, drew strenuous objections over the weekend from the Columbia Broadcasting System. The thinking behind the FCC proposals is to help sustain existing ultra-high-frequency stations and encourage the start of additional such outlets by guaranteeing them program resources that would win audiences. Most advertisers normally prefer the more powerful, very high-frequency stations. Under the controversial proposals, the total pool of network programming would be carved up among two VHF stations and one UHF station. The alleged justification for these proposals is the desire to correct competitive imbalance. Now observe today's situation in the sphere of labor. In Atlas Shrugged, I showed that at a time of desperate shortages of transportation, due to shortages of motive power, track, and fuel, the railroads of the country were ordered to run shorter trains at lower speeds. Today, at a time when the railroads are perishing, with most of them on the brink of bankruptcy, the railroad unions are demanding the preservation of featherbedding practices, that is, of useless, unneeded jobs, and of antiquated work and payment rules. The press comments on this issue were mixed, but one editorial deserves a moment's special attention. It is from the Star-Herald of Camden, New Jersey, of August 16, 1963, and it was sent to me by a fan. The moneymakers, the powerful business leaders of America, have failed to realize that prosperity can be inhuman. They have failed to understand that people take precedence over profits. Ambition and the drive for profit is a good thing. It spurs man to higher achievements. But it must be tempered by concern for society and its members. It must be slowed down in the light of human needs. These are the thoughts that trouble us when we ponder the railroad stalemate. Crying featherbed like a war whoop, the managers of the railroads have insisted on eliminating tens of thousands of jobs, jobs that are the mainstays of homes, jobs that mean the difference between a man's feeling dignified or futile. Before you vote yes for such painful progress, imagine your husband or brother or father as one of those destined to be sacrificed on the altar of progress. Far better, in our view, to have the government nationalize the railroads and prevent another human disaster on their one-way track of making profit at human expense. This editorial had no byline, but my anonymous admirer had written on it in penciled block letters, "By Eugene Lawson?" That kind of humanitarian attitude is not directed against profits, but against achievement. It is not directed against the rich, but against the competent. Do you think that the only victims of the mystic altruist collectivist axis are a few exceptional men on the top of the social pyramid, a few men of financial and intellectual genius? Here is an old clipping from my horror file, a news story dating years back. Britain is currently stirred by the story of a young coal miner who has quit his job to prevent 2,000 miners from striking at Doncaster. Alan Bulmer, 31, got in trouble with his fellow workers when he finished a week's assignment 3 hours ahead of time. Instead of sitting down for 3 hours, he started on a new stint of work. More than 2,000 miners held a meeting last Sunday to object to his working too hard. They demanded that he be demoted for 3 months and his pay cut from $36 a week to $25. Bulmer quit his job to end the crisis, with the statement that it always has been his belief that a man should do a full day's work for a full day's pay. Officials of the government-operated mines say the affair is up to the unions. Ask yourself, what will become of that young man in the future? How long will he preserve his integrity and his ambition if he knows that they will bring him punishments, not rewards? Will he continue to exercise his ability if he is to be demoted for it? This is how a nation loses the best of its men. Do you remember the scene in Atlas Shrugged, when Hank Reardon finally decided to go on strike? The last straw, which made the situation clear to him, was James Taggart's statement that he, Reardon, would always find a way to do something, even in the face of the most irrational and impossible demands. Compare that with the following quotation in a news story of December 28, 1959, which is a statement by Michael J. Quill, head of the Transport Workers Union, commenting on a threatened city transit strike. "A lot of people are thinking we're taking this to the brink, but it so happens that every time we went to the well before, there was something there." In the closing chapters of Atlas Shrugged, I described the labor situation of the country as follows. "Give us men," the plea began to hammer progressively louder upon the desk of the Unification Board from all parts of a country ravaged by unemployment. And neither the pleaders nor the board dared to add the dangerous words which the cry was implying, "Give us men of ability." There were waiting lines years long for the jobs of janitors, greasers, porters, and busboys. There was no one to apply for the jobs of executives, managers, superintendents, engineers. An editorial in the July 29, 1963 issue of Barron's mentions The mounting scarcity of skilled labor, including, as Dr. Arthur F. Burns noted in a recent critique of official unemployment statistics, extensive shortages of scientists, teachers, engineers, doctors, nurses, typists, stenographers, automobile and TV mechanics, tailors, and domestic servants. Do you remember the story of the Minnesota harvest disaster? And Atlas shrugged. A bumper crop of wheat perished along the roadsides, around the overfilled silos and grain elevators, for lack of railroad freight cars, which by government order had been sent to carry a harvest of soybeans. The following news story is from the Chicago Sun-Times of November 2, 1962. Illinois farm officials and grain dealers met Thursday in an effort to relieve an acute freight car shortage which is threatening Midwest's bumper grain harvest. Farmers and grain dealers agreed that the shortage of railroad boxcars has become critical and saw little hope of relief for at least 2 weeks. Some grain elevator operators showed the group photographs of corn piled on the ground near elevators plugged up with corn which can't be shipped. The boxcar shortage was blamed on the harvesting of three major crops, corn, soybeans, and milo, at the same time this year. In addition, there have been heavy movements of government-owned grain. In Atlas Shrugged, Ragnar Donishold denounced Robin Hood as the particular image of evil that he wanted to destroy in men's minds. He is the man who became the symbol of the idea that need, not achievement, is the source of rights, that we don't have to produce only to want, that the earned does not belong to us, but the unearned does. I shall never know whether Ragnar was or was not the inspiration of an article denouncing Robin Hood, which appeared last year in a British journal called Justice of the Peace and Local Government Review, a magazine of law and police affairs. The occasion for the article was the revival of the Robin Hood Festival. Having regard to the fact, said the article, that the exploits of this legendary hero were chiefly concerned with robbing the rich under the specious motive of giving to the poor, a function which in modern times has been taken over by the welfare state, it is a question of some doubt whether a Robin Hood festival is not contrary to public policy. But now we come to a composition that beats anything presented in Atlas Shrugged. I concede that I would have been unable to invent it, and that no matter how low my estimate of the altruist-collectivist mentalities, and it is very low, I would not have believed this possible. It is not fiction, it is a news story, which appeared on March 23, 1964, on the front page of the New York Times. Every American should be guaranteed an adequate income as a matter of right, whether he works or not. A 32-member group calling itself the Ad Hoc Committee on the Triple Revolution urged today. The three revolutions listed in their statement, which they sent to President Johnson, were the Cybernation Revolution, the Weaponry Revolution, and the Human Rights Revolution. The fundamental problem posed by the Cybernation Revolution in the United States is that it invalidates the general mechanism so far employed to undergird people's rights as consumers, the committee said. Up to this time, it continued, economic resources have been distributed on the basis of contributions to production, with machines and men competing for employment on somewhat equal terms. In the developing cybernated system, potentially unlimited output can be achieved by systems of machines which will require little cooperation from human beings. The continuance of the income through jobs link as the only major mechanism for distributing effective demand, for granting the right to consume, now acts as the main brake on the almost unlimited capacity of a cybernated productive system. The committee urged that the link be broken by an unqualified commitment by society to provide through its appropriate legal and governmental institutions every individual and every family with an adequate income as a matter of right. To be provided by whom? Blank out. One would expect a proclamation of this kind to be issued by a group of small-town crackpots, dissociated from reality and from any knowledge of economics. Or one would expect it to be issued by a group of rabble-rousers for the purpose of inciting the lowest elements of the population to violence against any business office that owns an electronic computer and thus deprives them of their right to consume. But such was not the case. This proclamation was issued by a group of professors, economists, educators, writers, and other intellectuals. What is frightening, as a symptom of the present state of our culture, is that it received front-page attention, and that apparently civilized people are willing to regard it as within the bounds of civilized discussion. What is the cultural atmosphere of our day? See whether the following description fits it. I quote from Atlas Shrugged, from a passage referring to a series of accelerating disasters and catastrophes. The newspapers did not mention it. The editorials went on speaking of self-denial as the road to future progress, of self-sacrifice as the moral imperative, of greed as the enemy, of love as the solution. Their threadbare phrases as sickeningly sweet as the odor of ether in a hospital. Rumors went spreading through the country in whispers of cynical terror, yet people read the newspapers and acted as if they believed what they read, each competing with the others on who would keep most blindly silent, each pretending that he did not know what he knew, each striving to believe that the unnamed was the unreal. It was as if a volcano were cracking open, yet the people at the foot of the mountain ignored the sudden fissures, the black fumes, the boiling trickles, and went on believing that their only danger was to acknowledge the reality of these signs. The purpose of my discussing this today was not to boast, nor to leave you with the impression that I possess some mystical gift of prophecy, but to demonstrate the exact opposite, that that gift is not mystical. Contrary to the prevalent views of today's alleged scholars, history is not an unintelligible chaos ruled by chance and whim. Historical trends can be predicted and changed. Men are not helpless, blind, doomed creatures carried to destruction by incomprehensible forces beyond their control. There's only one power that determines the course of history, just as it determines the course of every individual life, the power of man's rational faculty, the power of ideas. If you know a man's convictions, you can predict his actions. If you understand the dominant philosophy of a society, you can predict its course. But convictions and philosophy are matters open to man's choice. There is no fatalistic, predetermined historical necessity. Atlas Shrugged is not a prophecy of our unavoidable destruction, but a manifesto of our power to avoid it if we choose to change our course. It is the philosophy of the mysticism, altruism, collectivism axis that has brought us to our present state and is carrying us toward a finale such as that of the society presented in Atlas Shrugged. It is only the philosophy of the reason, individualism, capitalism axis that can save us and carry us, instead, toward the Atlantis projected in the last two pages of my novel. Since men have free will, no one can predict with certainty the outcome of an ideological conflict, nor how long such a conflict will last. It is too early to tell which choice this country will make. I can say only that if part of the purpose of Atlas Shrugged was to prevent itself from becoming prophetic, there are many, many signs to indicate that it is succeeding in that purpose. Postscript. Over a year after this article was written, there occurred an event worth noting here. In the last chapter of Atlas Shrugged, which describes the collapse of the collectivist's rule, there is the following paragraph. The plane was above the peaks of the skyscrapers, when suddenly, with the abruptness of a shudder, as if the ground had parted to engulf it, the city disappeared from the face of the earth. It took them a moment to realize that the panic had reached the power stations, and that the lights of New York had gone out. On November 9, 1965, the lights of New York and of the entire eastern seaboard went out. The situation was not exactly parallel to that in my story, but a great many readers recognized the symbolic meaning of the event. I quote some of the letters and wires I received in the next few days. A wire from Austin, Texas, signed by a number of names. We thought you said the novel was not prophetic. A wire from Marion, Wisconsin. There is a John Galt. From a letter from Indianapolis. But it didn't even take a panic, did it, Miss Rand? Just that same old irresponsibility and incompetence, The train wrecks, etc., have made us chuckle, but this fulfilled prophecy also brings a shudder. A note from Dundee, Scotland. I could not help but think of your book Atlas Shrugged when we saw on television New York without its lights, there on the screen the black canyons of the buildings and the low lights of the cars trying to find a way out. From Memphis, Tennessee, a postcard sent by his mother to a reader who sent it to me. I just had to pass this on. Last night in the blackout in the Northeast, a friend called and asked if you were there. I said no, and she said, well, I'm sorry. I wanted to ask him if Atlas had shrugged. A note from Chicago. We waited expectantly for the one rational explanation for the blackout of 11-9-65. This is John Galt speaking. Chapter 16, The Pull Peddlers, by Ayn Rand. America's foreign policy is so grotesquely irrational that most people believe there must be some sensible purpose behind it. The extent of the irrationality acts as its own protection. Like the technique of the big lie, it makes people assume that so blatant an evil could not possibly be as evil as it appears to them, and therefore that somebody must understand its meaning, even though they themselves do not. The sickening generalities and contradictions cited in justification of the foreign aid program fall roughly into two categories which are offered to us simultaneously, the idealistic and the practical, or mush and fear. The idealistic arguments consist of appeals to altruism and swim out of focus in a fog of floating abstractions about our duty to support the underdeveloped nations of the entire globe who are starving and will perish without our selfless help. The practical arguments consist of appeals to fear and emit a different sort of fog, to the effect that our own selfish interest requires that we go bankrupt buying the favor of the underdeveloped nations who otherwise will become a dangerous threat to us. It is useless to point out to the advocates of our foreign policy that it's either or. Either the underdeveloped nations are so weak that they are doomed without our help, in which case they cannot become a threat to us, or they are so strong that with some other assistance they can develop to the point of endangering us, in which case we should not drain our economic power to help the growth of potential enemies who are that powerful. It is useless to discuss the contradiction between these two assertions because neither of them is true. Their proponents are impervious to facts, to logic, and to the mounting evidence that after two decades of global altruism, our foreign policy is achieving the exact opposite of its alleged goals. It is wrecking our economy. It is reducing us internationally to the position of an impotent failure who has nothing but a series of compromises, retreats, defeats, and betrayals on his record. And instead of bringing progress to the world, it is bringing the bloody chaos of tribal warfare and delivering one helpless nation after another into the power of communism. When a society insists on pursuing a suicidal course, one may be sure that the alleged reasons and proclaimed slogans are mere rationalizations. The question is only, what is it that these rationalizations are hiding? Observe that there is no consistent pattern in the erratic chaos of our foreign aid, and although in the long run it leads to the benefit of Soviet Russia, Russia is not its direct immediate beneficiary. There is no consistent winner, only a consistent loser, the United States. In the face of such a spectacle, some people give up the attempt to understand. Others imagine that some omnipotent conspiracy is destroying America, that the rationalizations are hiding some malevolent, fantastically powerful giant. The truth is worse than that. The truth is that the rationalizations are hiding nothing, that there is nothing at the bottom of the fog but a nest of scurrying cockroaches. I submit in evidence excerpts from an article in the editorial section of the New York Times of July 15, 1962, entitled Role of Foreign Lobbies. A non-diplomatic corps of foreign agents, states the article, has bloomed in recent years in Washington. Lobbying in Congress to obtain or prevent the passage of legislation of interest to their foreign clients, seeking to pressure the administration into adopting certain political or economic policies, or attempting to mold public opinion through a myriad of methods and techniques. This legion of special agents has become an elusive shadow for operating in Washington, and the width and the length of the land. Lobbying is the activity of attempting to influence legislation by privately influencing the legislators. It is the result and creation of a mixed economy, of government by pressure groups. Its methods range from mere social courtesies and cocktail party or luncheon friendships to favors, threats, bribes, blackmail. All lobbyists, whether serving foreign or domestic interests, are required, by laws passed in the last 3 decades, to register with the government. The registrations have been growing at such a rate, with the foreign lobbyists outnumbering the domestic ones, that legislators are beginning to be alarmed. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee has announced that it is preparing an investigation of these foreign agents' activities. The New York Times article describes foreign lobbying as follows. The theory behind this whole enterprise is that for a fee or a retainer, and often for hundreds of thousands of dollars in advertising, publicity, and expense money, a foreign government or a foreign economic or political interest can purchase a favorable legislation in the United States Congress, a friendly policy of the administration, or a positive image in the eyes of the American public opinion, leading in turn to profitable political or economic advantage. Who are these lobbyists? Men with political pull, with access to influential Washington figures, American men hired by foreign interests. The article mentions that most of these men are Washington lawyers or New York public relations firms. Russia is one of these foreign interests and is served by registered lobbyists in Washington, but she is merely cashing in on the situation like the others. The success of her conspiracy in this country is the result, not the cause, of our self-destruction. She's winning by default. The cause is much deeper than that. The issue of lobbies has attracted attention recently through the struggle of foreign lobbyists to obtain sugar quotas from the American government. Their efforts, states the article, were centered on Representative Harold D. Cooley, Democrat of North Carolina, chairman of the House Committee on Agriculture, who at least until this year held almost the complete power in the distribution of quotas. It has never been too clear what criteria Mr. Cooley used in allocating these quotas, and by the same token, it is impossible to determine what was the actual effect of the lobbyists' entreaties on him. But in offering their services to foreign governments or sugar growers' associations, these representatives were in effect offering for sale their real or alleged friendship with Mr. Cooley. This is the core and essence of the issue of lobbying, and of our foreign aid, and of a mixed economy. The trouble is not that it has never been too clear what criteria Mr. Cooley used in allocating these quotas, but that it has never been and never can be too clear what criteria he was expected to use by the legislation that granted him these powers. No criteria can ever be defined in this context. Such is the nature of non-objective law and of all economic legislation. So long as a concept such as the public interest or the social or national or international interest is regarded as a valid principle to guide legislation, lobbies and pressure groups will necessarily continue to exist, since there is no such entity as the public, since the public is merely a number of individuals. The idea that the public interest supersedes private interests and rights can have but one meaning, that the interests and rights of some individuals take precedence over the interests and rights of others. If so, then all men and all private groups have to fight to the death for the privilege of being regarded as the public. The government's policy has to swing like an erratic pendulum from group to group, hitting some and favoring others at the whim of any given moment, and so grotesque a profession as lobbying, selling influence, becomes a full-time job. If parasitism, favoritism, corruption, and greed for the unearned did not exist, a mixed economy would bring them into existence. Since there is no rational justification for the sacrifice of some men to others, there is no objective criterion by which such a sacrifice can be guided in practice. All public interest legislation and any distribution of money taken by force from some men for the unearned benefit of others, comes down ultimately to the grant of an undefined, undefinable, non-objective, arbitrary power to some government officials. The worst aspect of it is not that such a power can be used dishonestly, but that it cannot be used honestly. The wisest man in the world, with the purest integrity, cannot find a criterion for the just, equitable, rational application of an unjust, inequitable, irrational principle. The best that an honest official can do is to accept no material bribe for his arbitrary decision, but this does not make his decision and its consequences more just or less calamitous. A man of clear-cut convictions is impervious to anyone's influence. But when clear-cut convictions are impossible, personal influences take over. When a man's mind is trapped in the foggy labyrinth of the non-objective that has no exits and no solutions, he will welcome any quasi-persuasive, semi-plausible argument. Lacking certainty, he will follow anyone's facsimile thereof. He is the natural prey of social manipulators, of propaganda salesmen, of lobbyists. When any argument is as inconclusive as any other, the subjective, emotional, or human element becomes decisive. A harried legislator may conclude, consciously or subconsciously, that the friendly man who smiled at him at the cocktail party last week was a good person who would not deceive him and whose opinion can be trusted safely. It is by considerations such as these that officials may dispose of your money, your effort, and your future. Although cases of actual corruption do undoubtedly exist among legislators and government officials, they are not a major motivating factor in today's situation. It is significant that in such cases as have been publicly exposed, the bribes were almost pathetically small. Men who held the power to dispose of millions of dollars sold their favors for $1,000 rug or a fur coat or a refrigerator. The truth, most likely, is that they did not regard it as bribery or as a betrayal of their public trust. They did not think that their particular decision could matter one way or another in the kind of causeless choices they had to make, in the absence of any criteria, in the midst of the general orgy of tossing away an apparently ownerless wealth. Men who would not sell out their country for $1 million are selling it out for somebody's smile and a vacation trip to Florida. Paraphrasing John Galt, it is of such pennies and smiles that the destruction of your country is made. The general public is helplessly bewildered. The intellectuals do not care to look at our foreign policy too closely. They feel guilt. They sense that their own worn-out ideologies, which they dare not challenge, are the cause of the consequences which they dare not face. The more they evade, the greater their eagerness to grasp at any fashionable straw or rationalization and to uphold it with glassy-eyed aggressiveness. The threadbare cloak of altruism serves to cover it up and to sanction the evasions by a fading aura of moral righteousness. The exhausted cynicism of a bankrupt culture, of a society without values, principles, convictions, or intellectual standards, does the rest. It leaves a vacuum for anyone to fill. The motive power behind the suicidal bleeding of the greatest country in the world is not an altruistic fervor or a collectivist crusade any longer, but the manipulations of little lawyers and public relations men pulling the mental strings of lifeless automatons. These, the lobbyists in the pay of foreign interests, the men who could not hope to get in any other circumstances the money they are getting now, are the real and only profiteers on the global sacrifice, as their ilk has always been at the close of every altruistic movement in history. It is not the underdeveloped nations, nor the underprivileged masses, nor the starving children of jungle villages who benefit from America's self-immolation. It is only the men who are too small to start such movements, and small enough to cash in at the end. It is not any lofty ideal that the altruism-collectivism doctrine accomplishes, or can ever accomplish. Its end of trail is as follows. A local railroad had gone bankrupt in North Dakota, abandoning the region to the fate of a blighted area. The local banker had committed suicide, first killing his wife and children. A freight train had been taken off the schedule in Tennessee, leaving a local factory without transportation at a day's notice. The factory owner's son had quit college and was now in jail awaiting execution for a murder committed with a gang of raiders. A way station had been closed in Kansas, and the station agent, who had wanted to be a scientist, had given up his studies and become a dishwasher. That he, James Taggart, might sit in a private barroom and pay for the alcohol pouring down Orrin Boyle's throat, for the waiter who sponged Boyle's garments when he spilled his drink over his chest, for the carpet burned by the cigarettes of an ex-pimp from Chile who did not want to take the trouble of reaching for an ashtray across a distance of 3 feet. Chapter 17. Extremism, or the Art of Smearing, by Ayn Rand. Among the many symptoms of today's moral bankruptcy, the performance of the so-called moderates at the Republican National Convention was the climax, at least to date. It was an attempt to institutionalize smears as an instrument of national policy, to raise those smears from the private gutters of yellow journalism to the public summit of a proposed inclusion in a political party platform. The moderates were demanding a repudiation of extremism without any definition of that term. Ignoring repeated challenges to define what they meant by extremism, substituting vituperation for identification, they kept the debate on the level of concretes and would not name the wider abstractions or principles involved. They poured abuse on a few specific groups and would not disclose the criteria by which these groups had been chosen. The only thing clearly perceivable to the public was a succession of snarling faces and hysterical voices screaming with violent hatred while denouncing purveyors of hate and demanding tolerance. When men feel that strongly about an issue, yet refuse to name it, when they fight savagely for some seemingly incoherent, unintelligible goal, one may be sure that their actual goal would not stand public identification. Let us therefore proceed to identify it. First, observe the peculiar incongruity of the concretes chosen as the objects of the moderates' hatred: the Communist Party, the Ku Klux Klan, and the John Birch Society. If one attempts to abstract the common attribute, the principle by which these three groups could be linked together, one finds none, or none more specific than political group. Obviously, this is not what the moderates had in mind. The common attribute, the moderates would snarl at this point, is evil. Okay, what evil? The Communist Party is guilty of the wholesale slaughter of countless millions spread through every continent of the globe. The Ku Klux Klan is guilty of murdering innocent victims by the mob violence of lynchings. What is the John Birch Society guilty of? The only answer elicited from the moderates was, they accused General Eisenhower of being a communist. The worst category of crime in which this accusation could be placed is libel. Let us leave aside the fact that libel is what every anti-welfare statist is chronically subjected to in public discussions. Let us agree that libel is a serious offense and ask only one question. Does libel belong to the same category of evil as the actions of the Communist Party and the Ku Klux Klan? Are we to regard wholesale slaughter, lynch murders, and libel as equal evils? If one heard a man declaring, "I am equally opposed to bubonic plague, to throwing acid in people's faces, and to my mother-in-law's nagging," would one conclude that the mother-in-law was the only object of his hatred, and that her elimination was his only goal? The same principle applies to both examples of the same technique. No one truly opposed to the Communist Party and the Ku Klux Klan would take their evil so lightly as to equate it with the activities of a futile, befuddled organization whose alleged sin, at worst, might be irresponsible recklessness in making unproved or libelous assertions. And more, the Communist Party as such is not a campaign issue, neither for the Republicans nor the Democrats, nor the electorate at large. Virtually everybody is denouncing the Communist Party these days, and nobody needs the reassurance of a formal repudiation. The Ku Klux Klan is not a Republican issue or problem. Its members traditionally are Democrats. For the Republicans to repudiate their vote would be like repudiating the vote of Tammany Hall, which is not theirs to repudiate. This leaves only the John Birch Society as a real issue for a Republican convention, and it was the real issue, but in a deeper and more devious sense than might appear on the surface. The real issue was not the John Birch Society as such. That society was merely an artificial and somewhat unworthy straw man, picked by the moderates as a focal point for the intended destruction of much greater and much more important victims. Observe that everyone at the Republican convention seemed to understand the implicit purpose behind the issue of extremism, but nobody would name it explicitly. The debate was conducted in terms of enormous, undefined package deals, as if words were merely approximations intended to connote an issue no one dared to denote. The result gave the impression of a life-and-death struggle conducted out of focus. The same atmosphere dominates the public controversy now raging over this issue. People are arguing about extremism as if they knew what that word meant, yet no two statements use it in the same sense, and no two speakers seem to be talking about the same subject. If there ever was a Tower of Babel situation, this is surely it. Please note that that is an important part of the issue. In fact, most people do not know the meaning of the word extremism. They merely sense it. They sense that something is being put over on them by some means which they cannot grasp. In order to understand what is done and how it is being done, let us observe some earlier instances of the same technique. A large-scale instance in the 1930s was the introduction of the word isolationism into our political vocabulary. It was a derogatory term, suggesting something evil, and it had no clear, explicit definition. It was used to convey two meanings, one alleged and the other real, and to damn both. The alleged meaning was defined approximately like this. Isolationism is the attitude of a person who is interested only in his own country and is not concerned with the rest of the world. The real meaning was patriotism and national self-interest. What exactly is concern with the rest of the world, since nobody did or could maintain the position that the state of the world is of no concern to this country? The term isolationism was a straw man used to misrepresent the position of those who were concerned with this country's interests. The concept of patriotism was replaced by the term isolationism and vanished from public discussion. The number of distinguished patriotic leaders smeared, silenced, and eliminated by that tag would be hard to compute. Then, by a gradual, imperceptible process, the real purpose of the tag took over. The concept of concern was switched into selfless concern. The ultimate result was a view of foreign policy which is wrecking the United States to this day. The suicidal view that our foreign policy must be guided not by considerations of national self-interest, but by concern for the interests and welfare of the world, that is, of all countries except our own. In the late 1940s, another newly coined term was shot into our cultural arteries, McCarthyism. Again, it was a derogatory term, suggesting some insidious evil and without any clear definition. Its alleged meaning was unjust accusations, persecutions, and character assassinations of innocent victims. Its real meaning was anti-communism. Senator McCarthy was never proved guilty of those allegations, but the effect of that term was to intimidate and silence public discussions. Any uncompromising denunciation of communism or communists was, and still is, smeared as McCarthyism. As a consequence, opposition to and exposés of communist penetration have all but vanished from our intellectual scene. I must mention that I am not an admirer of Senator McCarthy, but not for the reasons implied in that smear. Now consider the term extremism. Its alleged meaning is intolerance, hatred, racism, bigotry, crackpot theories, incitement to violence. Its real meaning is the advocacy of capitalism. Observe the technique involved in these three examples. It consists of creating an artificial, unnecessary, and rationally unusable term designed to replace and obliterate some legitimate concepts. a term which sounds like a concept, but stands for a package deal of disparate, incongruous, contradictory elements taken out of any logical conceptual order or context. A package deal whose approximately defining characteristic is always a non-essential. This last is the essence of the trick. Let me remind you that the purpose of a definition is to distinguish the thing subsumed under a single concept from all other things in existence, and therefore their defining characteristic must always be that essential characteristic which distinguishes them from everything else. So long as men use language, that is the way they will use it. There is no other way to communicate. And if a man accepts a term with a definition by non-essentials, his mind will substitute for it the essential characteristic of the objects he's trying to designate. For instance, concern or non-concern with the rest of the world is not an essential characteristic of any theory of foreign relations. If a man hears the term isolationists applied to a number of individuals, he will observe that the essential characteristic distinguishing them from other individuals is patriotism, and he will conclude that isolationism means patriotism, and that patriotism is evil. Thus, the real meaning of the term will automatically replace the alleged meaning. If a man hears the term McCarthyism, he will observe that the best-known characteristic distinguishing Senator McCarthy from other public figures is an anti-communist stand, and he will conclude that anti-communism is evil. If a man hears the term extremism and is offered the innocuous figure of the John Birch Society as an example, he will observe that its best-known characteristic is conservatism, and he will conclude that conservatism is evil as the Communist Party and the Ku Klux Klan. Conservatism is itself a loose, undefined, badly misleading term, but in today's popular usage it is taken to mean pro-capitalism. Such is the function of modern smear tags, and such is the process by which they destroy our public communications, making rational discussion of political issues impossible. The same mentalities that create an anti-hero in order to destroy heroes and an anti-novel in order to destroy novels are creating anti-concepts in order to destroy concepts. The purpose of anti-concepts is to obliterate certain concepts without public discussion, and as a means to that end, to make public discussion unintelligible, and to induce the same disintegration in the mind of any man who accepts them, rendering him incapable of clear thinking or rational judgment. No mind is better than the precision of its concepts. This book is continued on Disc 7.